far, we have stayed very rigorously to the contours of Eleanor's life as we know it in history. Will new charters and other documents tell us more? Of course they will. And the hope is that more might be discovered. And it's that hope that keeps historians in the archives and scholars meeting at conferences talking about Eleanor of Aquitaine. But in this lecture, we ask, where does the historical narrative end? And where do the legends begin? And can we tell the difference? For fact and fiction conspire with each other in the representations of Eleanor of Aquitaine. The historical blanks and gaps in Eleanor's crusade have been filled to overflowing from the 12th through the 21st century by lurid and leering speculation, mostly, of course, about sex. Hers is a story full of sex and violence, of suspense and teeth-grinding tenacity connected to the brilliant conflicting wills of Eleanor and of Henry particularly. Who could ask for anything more? One wonders why both Cole Porter and Noel Coward didn't get together with Edith Piaf to put together a rendition of Eleanor of Aquitaine. Certainly not the gossips of her own time asked for more, nor do the writers and artists of subsequent generations. What are some of the lusty legends that surround this woman, and what new ones seem to continue to arise? First, let's contrast what gets said about Eleanor with what we know of the historic record. These stories accumulated in vast numbers over the long generations. She was, it was said, the greatest heiress in Christendom, married and crowned Queen of France at 13. This we know to be true, and that in itself is an exciting fact of her life. She, it is said, bemoaned an unexciting marriage to Louis VII. And that may or may not be true. We do not know what Eleanor's attitude was towards that marriage until she was in Antioch and began to make noises which entered the historical record about the issue of consanguinity, that is, began to say that she thought perhaps she and Louis were too closely married, too closely related by blood in order to stay married. We're told also that she rode bare-breasted to the Crusades like an Amazon. She went off in her armor. Well, we know that she went on crusade, but I think it's a 17th century story that begins to tell us that Eleanor and her ladies were imitating Amazons, that is, those readers who could understand women and warfare only through the lenses of the Amazons, then cast Eleanor into that kind of story as well. And we're told that she dallied scandalously with her uncle at Antioch. We know they dallied. But how did they dally? We'll return to that later. We're told that she tried to escape from Louis with the irresistible Saladin. Now, we might ask ourselves when we think about their comparative ages whether Eleanor liked them quite that young. We know that she returned to France to divorce Louis, and that is certainly true enough. And we know that she passionately adored and then fought endlessly with her second husband, Henry II of England. And that, alas, is all too true. We're told that she poisoned Henry's mistress, Fair Rosamond, Rosamond Clifford. We have no proof of that, but were it fidelity that she demanded from Henry, she would have poisoned him and poisoned him long before he met Fair Rosamond. We're told that she presided as Henry, then Richard's lieutenant in the Aquitaine. And that, too, is true. But she was also, in that case, acting not simply as regent for Henry and then for her son, who was the Duke of the Aquitaine, but rather acting in her own name as lord and overlord of the Aquitaine, since she was its duchess and lord. We're told furthermore that she held courts of love in which cases about love were judged, and those who were judged were sent out either to love better or not at all. And we're told that she engaged in and approved of various kinds of love liaisons. And this, I think, we'll return to later to determine whether we find it true or false. We're told furthermore that she was imprisoned as a rebellious and cross-dressing queen. rather like the Joan of Arc, of whom we'll hear later. A cross-dressing queen? Well, it's actually true. When she was trying to escape from Henry, when Henry was trying to put her in prison, she actually dressed herself as a man in order to see if she could escape the guards who were pursuing her. And for a short time, she was able to slip under the barriers and cease to be recognized. But she was not able, finally, to evade capture, and Henry was able to imprison her. We're told also that she was a kind of relentlessly domineering mother who made her children's lives miserable and manipulated their politics almost to her last breath. She was certainly a mother interested in politics and interested in the politics in which her children would engage. She certainly helped shape their political consciousness. Was she, however, the manipulating virago who was horrid in her control of them? That, again, depends upon how you interpret the historic record. Some would say that she simply carried out the proper functions of queenly maternity. Others would say she went too far and ought to have left all those matters in the hand of her husband and their father. In our previous lectures, we have sifted quite strictly through the information provided to us by those sources considered by contemporary historians to be true, our contemporaries who are historians. In these lectures thus far, we've depended upon the nuggets of new information mixed with excellent new narratives provided by the historians who have participated in the volume I've co-edited called Eleanor of Aquitaine, Lord and Lady. We expect that new biographers will use that volume to see more clearly lines between fact and fiction in the case of Eleanor. The book-length biographies of Eleanor that are now available still tend to mix fiction and fact. Even the books that carefully separate into separate chapters, ones that say fact and others that say fiction, for instance, the one by D.D.R. Owen, somehow all of the stories of Eleanor tend to get muddled together. This mixture of fact and fiction tends to turn metaphors or suggestive hints about Eleanor into some kind of hard reality. In our previous lectures, we've tried to separate out those things we know to be hard reality from suggestions that we don't want to harden too quickly into fact. Be careful now, however, because in this lecture, we're talking about all of those lurid pieces of information which attached themselves to Eleanor. Because the myths themselves are compelling, telling us, among other things, what commentators from the 12th to the 21st century themselves think about women, about sexuality, about motherhood, and about how women handle power. What stories do we have, for example, about Eleanor when she went on crusade? On Easter of 1146, we will remember, Eleanor heard Bernard of Clairvaux preach the Second Crusade at Vézelay, and she and Louis fulfilled their well-understood intention to go on crusade by taking the cross at that highly charged symbolic moment. We know, of course, it took them many months to prepare to actually leave on crusade, but they took the cross and pledged themselves to go on crusade at that moment. We now recognize what previous historians obscured. Eleanor did not merely accompany her husband when he went on crusade. She herself went on crusade just as he did. She took the cross just as he did. She was a crusader and not merely the wife of a crusader. Crusading was a pilgrimage of desire for God as much as it was a war against the infidel. And it was on that search, and all the other sorts of searches we can name, that Eleanor took herself. For medieval people in general, the image of woman among warriors conjures up scenes of licentiousness, although in her own day, these remarks were carefully sub rosa. There were no accusations in her own day that Eleanor's general behavior and demeanor on crusade were anything but appropriate. No contemporary historian now can yet tell us what Eleanor's full role was during her crusade. Was she acting as lords of her troops from the Aquitaine, of whom there were many? Was she cavorting like an Amazon at play, as some say? Did she, like Louis himself, think of herself as undertaking a penitential pilgrimage for all the wrongs that had accumulated in her soul through her whole life? We don't know. Many women, it seems, undertook the first crusade, but Eleanor is by far the most famous to have attempted the second. Many of us cut our medieval milk teeth on the story first recounted by Gervase of Canterbury about Eleanor cavorting with her ladies in armor or billowing red and white costumes shaped in the form of the single-breasted Amazon warrior woman when she went on crusade with her husband Louis. Odo of Doy lists that some of the many noble ladies and 300 less exalted women vowed crusade on that same day. More than a year later, on the Feast of Saint Denis in 1147, with goods, troops, friends, and servants, the royal couple began their campaign, not to return to France until 2.5 years later, in November of 1149. By the late 17th century, stories had spread all across Europe of Eleanor as a latter-day Hippolyta, leading a battalion of women warriors in full armor. Armored, that is, except for their bravely and titillatingly exposed breasts that marked them as an Amazon. Eleanor's sexual immorality before and during the campaign of the Crusades was allegedly flagrant, according to the 17th century chroniclers and later ones. Not satisfied by her penitent, feminized husband, the story goes, after all, Louis was raised in the monastery next to Saint-Denis itself, Eleanor had an affair before leaving France, we are told, be prepared, with Henry II's father, Geoffrey of Anjou. And we're told that she was trying to decide which she would have when she returned and achieved her divorce, the father or the son. While on crusade, we're told that she was passionately linked with her uncle, Raymond of Antioch. These and even more salacious stories are still recycled in contemporary fiction. Lest I be arrested for the corruption of youth or adult citizens, I won't give you the full bibliographical details for a book I innocently purchased in LaGuardia Airport several years ago. Aptly called The Scarlet Raptures of Eleanor of Aquitaine, it graphically details how the sensy and saucy, sensual Eleanor stroked the crowned jewels of Europe's royal heads. She is alleged to have treated her crusade as a sexual experiment, betting the Randy Raymond and even the Emperor Manuel Comnenus, her relations, of course, with Bernard of Clairvaux, with the abbot Suger, with her handmaidens, and naturally her horses, are also described in remarkable detail. But best of all are the hand-me-down stories of Eleanor and Saladin, called the Intrepid Turk. By the 19th century, stories about Eleanor and the great Saracen warrior Saladin are fully developed. The assumption of these stories is that any woman with Eleanor's spirit would naturally desire a magnificent, dark warrior, just as any magnificent, dark warrior would desire a magnificent, white, Western woman. We're told that Eleanor almost escapes to join Saladin when she was betrayed by a handmaiden and yanked back by Louis. Now, Eleanor was notable for robbing the cradle by marrying a man almost 10 years younger than she in Henry II. But surely even the most gullible historians would have paused had they looked at the ages of these two, since Saladin was only 12 when Eleanor was in Antioch. But this story got wrapped into the history of Eleanor, repeated even by those who might have known better. Even in Eleanor's time, however, there were rumors from John of Salisbury and others about her relations with her uncle, Raymond. One current writer of popular biography today, Alison Weir, is so overwhelmed by what she calls the evidence of intimacy between Raymond and Eleanor that she thinks this evidence has been almost willfully downplayed by historians. Weir is right, I think, to say that Eleanor and her uncle were intimate, but wrong, I think, to make the presumption that their intimacy was physical rather than political, though it was certainly grounded in the quick intimacy of emotional sympathy. But of the physical between them, we know nothing, though even her contemporaries delighted in almost, but not quite, alleging her infidelity. If there had been real physical infidelity to King Louis, as Dartmouth historian Charles Wood recently remarked to me in an email, given the lack of privacy that was the ever-present reality of servant-pampered upper classes of that day, not to mention all the rules surrounding the necessary chastity of a queen, there would have been no way to keep a physical relationship private. Real infidelity would surely have left much more and of a paper, if not sheet, trail. Having been between the sheets with two kings, Eleanor was perfect fodder for medieval and modern scandal sheets. And the fact that her family had what we might call a propensity for weird relationship issues. William, Eleanor, and John were all medieval divorcees, adds more smoke to the issue. In any case, these stories also got wrapped into the salacious history of Eleanor. Perhaps the most popular of all rumors about Eleanor involved her supposed hatred and murder of Henry II's mistress, Rosamond Clifford, by whom he was supposedly gobsmacked, simply dazed in love. In 1765, Bishop Thomas Percy published a ballad which he claimed had been written down in the 16th century by one Thomas Delaunay, a ballad maker as well as a silk weaver. Delaunay's long ballad on Fair Rosamond tells the listener, now usually the reader, that Rosamond was young, beautiful, sweet, and utterly devoted to Henry, and hence Eleanor was known to be her deadly foe. For of the many words that we connect with the story of Eleanor, she was once young, she was always beautiful, she was utterly devoted to Henry, but no one ever said she was sweet. When Henry was off in France dealing with the rebellion of one of his ungracious sons, Eleanor went with some of her own men to the ingeniously constructed labyrinth-like secret bower which Henry had had built for Rosamond, which was near his favorite manor of Woodstock. Eleanor confronted Rosamond, we're told, after her men had killed Rosamond's bodyguards. Rosamond wept, begging piteously for her life, offering to become a nun or wander the wide world, whatever Eleanor chose. Pitiless, unappeased, furious, Queen Eleanor, we're told, would not relent and forced Rosamond in her presence, to drink a cup of poison. According to Bishop Piercy, earlier antiquarians had found at the nunnery of Godstow on the Thames, right across from what is now the Trout Pub, a tomb inscription which said, in part, according to Piercy in 1765, "Hic jacet in tumba Rosa Mundi, non Rosa Munda, non redolet sed olet, que rodole solet." Here lies entombed the rose of the world, not a clean rose, Rosa Munda. You can smell her now, whose scent used to have such perfume. Rarely has a pun said it so well. Rosa Munda, non Rosa Mundi. There is just no shred of information about Eleanor having met Rosamond, though this story also is one that has been wrapped into the history of Eleanor. The most persistent myths surrounding Eleanor and accepted by scholars and general readers is that she was involved in real courts of love. These stories originated in the 12th century with the brilliant writer Andreas Capellanus in his daring 12th century treatise, later condemned by the church, called the De Amore, which means on love. And here we have a revision of Ovid's Art of Love, but in the hands of Andreas, a three-part tract in which he describes, first of all, what love is and how one speaks to one's beloved. In the second part, he tells you what to do in order to retain love if it is lost. And in the third part, quite shockingly, he tells young men how to avoid love and the wicked wiles of horrible women and to choose to love God instead. With a trajectory like that, which brings you immediately to the desire for God rather than women, it's amazing to most scholars that the church came down on Andreas so hard. Perhaps they came down on Andreas so hard because love was not so much his subject or object as it was an occasion for putting forward ideas in a dialectical form, very much as Abelard had put forward ideas in a dialectical form in his conversations, among others, with Eloise. Many presume, however, in the case of Eleanor, that between the years 1168 and 1173, she was cavorting in her French daughter's courts, and she was judging witty courtiers who presented keenly argued cases about why their pleas as lovers ought to be accepted. Let me give you just an example of one. But in the opinion of Queen Eleanor, who was consulted on the matter, she seemed to be just the opposite. She said, "We know that it comes from the nature of love that those who are in love often pretend that they desire new embraces, that they may the better test the faith and constancy of their co-lover. Therefore, a woman sins against the nature of love itself if she keeps back her embraces from her lover on that account, or forbids him her love, unless she has clear evidence that he has been unfaithful to her. Reserve your jealousy, in other words," she says to women, we are told. And we might think that Andreas is reflecting on Eleanor's own life. It's very interesting at this moment to think that what is being said, supposedly in her daughter's own court, the daughter's whose legitimacy was significantly sustained, although Eleanor had managed to have her marriage to their father annulled. And she says, a love affair, Andrea says, was submitted for her judgment. A certain man who had in ignorance joined in love with a woman who was related to him sought to leave her when he discovered his fault. But the woman was bound by the chain of love and tried to keep him in love's observances, saying that the crime was fully excused by that fact when they began to enjoy the love it was without any sin. So no matter what they discovered later, in the early stages, they felt sinless in their love. What does the queen say about this? It's sounding very much like her marriage to Louis. In this affair, the queen answered as follows. A woman who, under the excuse of a mistake of any kind, seeks to preserve an incestuous love, that is, any close relationship is considered incestuous, is clearly going contrary to what is right and proper. We are always bound to oppose any of those incestuous and damnable actions which we know even human laws publish by heavy penalties. It's not surprising that this text of Andreas has tantalized historians as well as literary scholars ever since. It's hard to resist Andreas's conceit here of using Eleanor as a spokeswoman for the rules of love which he wants to promulgate. We should remember, of course, that the love of which he speaks here is love that takes place only among people who are not married to each other. In a long dialogue, he says, those who are married to each other cannot love because their love is not free. He and Eloise would have understood each other well. We know, of course, that on the very day, May 1st of 1174, that Andreas says this court of love was held in which Eleanor gave judgments, Eleanor was already imprisoned by Henry II and was therefore not, it was not possible that she would be found at that court. But Andreas gives up a literary conceit, but one that matches so well the rumors about Eleanor that it slips into the record easily as if it were history. On the other hand, Eleanor knew this new language of love well through the troubadour tradition initiated by her grandfather and by such influential courtiers as the first-rate troubadour Bernard de Ventadour in her own day. Bernard de Ventadour, for example, may well have been dismissed from Eleanor's entourage for claiming an intimacy with Eleanor that offended her young husband, Henry. We know Bernard's songs pleased Eleanor, but did she take them as anything more than an abstract compliment? So typical of the courtly lover of a sort found at her father and grandfather's courts. Some of these courtiers would have panicked and run, surely, had the lady in question accepted their advances. Was it all smoke without fire? But it is Bernard who wrote excellent love songs praising Eleanor, who was, the chronicler says, young and most worthy, well acquainted with merit, honor, and fine flattery. Bernard and Eleanor may have understood the game of love praising, but perhaps others at those cold northern courts were scandalized to hear his love moaning for the queen. In any case, he was dismissed from court, and the story began to grow. So this story also got wrapped into the story of Eleanor. And then there are the movies and the plays. Eleanor is portrayed more often than the Abbess Eloise, far more often than Hildegard, but nowhere near as many times as the warrior Joan of Arc. Eleanor had the good luck, however, of being played by a very great actress, Katharine Hepburn, in the brilliant movie Lion and Winter. In it, we have a sense of the passion that persisted between Eleanor and Henry, even when they held daggers at each other's backs. The movie gives us one of the few successful portrayals of a sexually vibrant older woman in American movie-making history. The French have always done that well, Americans rarely. Her forceful personality, Eleanor's forceful personality, not speaking here of Hepburn, her forceful personality, which is usually softened by Hollywood, is here part of her attraction for the powerful bear of a man that we see in Henry. And who could forget that great off-the-cuff line from Eleanor when she has just provoked a real crisis, one that frightened her even more than it amused her, between father and son. Oh, well, she says, every family has its ups and downs. Other movies we know are in the works about Eleanor of Aquitaine, but it's hard to imagine one that will surpass this classic. We know much about the Duchess and the Queen. It's the woman we yearn to know and cannot find, except here in bits and pieces of charters and everywhere in our imaginations. It's a pity we know so little. I report with sorrow that even with the best attempts of contemporary historians in the Eleanor of Aquitaine Lord and Lady collection, current historians, especially the great E.A.R. Brown, have alas put paid to many of these nasty, if always compelling, stories about Eleanor. But fascination with Eleanor, as a woman of easy virtue and independent means, still draws students to the study of medieval history. It's possible while you, to whom thanks, are listening to this lecture, and while I'm giving it, someone else is writing another story of Eleanor. These stories will persist as long as we want Eleanor's extraordinarily rich life to spill into a riot of excess. Our fascination with Eleanor is like our fascination with King Arthur. We're fascinated by the legends and romances that provide a mythic scaffold around these characters. We want truth, we history and historians and listeners, but not at the expense of the mythic scaffolding. So consider the story as we have told it, as we hear it now in terms of what Winston Churchill once said about King Arthur. It's all true, or ought to be, and more and better besides. Then this story, our story, as we have told it, will also get wrapped into the history of Eleanor of Aquitaine.